slide shows you where we're going, starting there at the end of chapter 2. So go ahead and head that way in your Bible. I think I'm not on. Did y'all hear that?
Talk louder.
Can you hear me now? Oh, he's sitting down. You'll have to talk. How about now?
Yeah, there you go.
There we go. Which part did you miss? Song of Solomon. The slides got it. We're going to begin toward the end of chapter 2 because we dawdled too long and didn't manage our time well last time we were going through this, and we're going to try to do better tonight, even though we're dealing with a whole lot more text. A couple of reminders, though, before we do that. We got a couple of really important events coming up, starting Friday with the men's weekend. Mark that down. Friday, 7:30 will be the start time. There'll be some sessions on Saturday. And then remember, Bubba Garner is going to stay over even till Sunday morning and preach for us. And so we're looking forward to that. And then in November, the 5th through the 7th, is that special weekend of study we're going to be. It's going to be a different kind of event than a traditional gospel meeting. Friday night will be pretty traditional. We'll have some singing at 7, and then a lesson. Don Truex is going to be speaking for us Friday night. But Saturday is going to be a whole series of classes. You'll have options of 4 classes at every hour at 10 and 11. We'll take a lunch break, come back at 2, even have a class for our junior high and high school kids. Nothing below that, but there'll be a class for junior and high school, and then a lot of classes for you guys to choose from. We'll get some data out about that this week, so you can be looking that over and thinking about it. But mark out that schedule on your weekend. I think it's going to be a really profitable weekend of study, important for all of us to be here for that. Back to the song, though. Remember, we've been working through this book. We've already laid out that it's a book that gives us God's message about sex or his plan for sex. And we've talked about how important and vital that message is for our culture. Also, it's poetry.
Right, which means we need to remember that it's about metaphor. It's about image and symbolism. You know, we know better than to try to push something like the book of Revelation into a fine, you know, it's exactly what it, you know, what the symbol says it is. No, it's poetry. And we wouldn't do that to Revelation. Don't do that to the Song of Songs either. Imagery here that's meant to kind of create a range of ideas, a little bit ambiguity sometimes. The great mystery of human marital love is conveyed in poetry, not prose, because there's always a little bit of ambiguity, mystery to the way between a man and a woman.
Well, it's fitting. You wouldn't want the Bible's books about romantic love to be written out on a spreadsheet.
Bullet points.
Right, yes, yeah. Poetry is the kind of literature appropriate for the topic.
Right.
But it does present us with some challenge because poetry is subject, we need to be careful about this, but subject to some interpretation.
Sure. We want a precise, one-to-one correlation and meaning, and that's not the point. The point of poetry is to open up, not on the limited range of possibilities, but a range of possibilities, because again, as you put it so well, you know, every couple in their marriage does their own dance. Right. And so there's no one. There are wrong ways to do marriage and marital love and sexuality, but there are multiple right ways as well. And that's why poetry, with its inherent ambiguity and numerous potential possibilities, is the right way to do this.
So I think one of the things that's helpful when we work through the book is to look for the central message.
Right.
Don't get too concerned with trying to figure out every detail and its significance. But what is the central truth being conveyed in the poem? I think that's pretty easy to come together on. When you get off into some of the fringe, into the detail, it's a little tougher. It's kind of like what we do with parables.
Right.
We look for that central message.
Right.
And then sometimes, you know, maybe the detail's just window dressing.
That's exactly right. Don't worry about who sold the oil to the virgins.
Correct. Okay, so look at our 3 questions on the slide, because we're going to work through these with the segments we deal with tonight. And hoping that by working this way, it will give you some mechanisms to use at home as you try to read through the book and understand it better, some ways to approach it. So remember, as we read it, just think about what you see, what is there, what registers with you. And then secondly, how does that begin to form into a message? What could that central idea or the point be? And then, of course, once we figured out that, we're ready for the last question of that. What do we do with it? How does it apply to us today? So we're going to pick up at the end of chapter 2 in verse 15. We planned to talk about this last time. I'm kind of glad it didn't work out that way.
Works better tonight.
So I think the more Jeff and I thought about this week, the more we began to see some connecting threads between this last part of 2 and then what's going on in 3. And so this would be another example of Jeff's favorite Bible complaint, and that is bad chapter breaks. So maybe the chapter break should have been at 2:15.
Well, in this song, it's almost impossible anyway. So.
It has its challenges.
It does.
So we're going to finish
it
up 15. Let's read this little segment together. And remember, as we read it, just think about what you might recognize. What do you see as we read together? This is verse 15. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies. Till the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, turn my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bether. So, it jumps out to you when you read that. What do you see? One of the things I see is we're back to nature again.
Right. Strong nature imagery all the way through the book to describe their relationship.
And that some of that has a backward tie, because we read about the vineyard blossoming here, and that makes me think about springtime. That's when
right.
the blossoms come. And that was the figure just before that, right?
Right.
Beginning in verse 10.
Right.
When the male character here invites his beloved out into the spring, and what he's clearly describing as spring, verse 13, the vines are in blossom,
right.
living forth their fragrance. And we talked about that, how that's a symbol for their budding relationship.
Well, right. The spring is a time of new life and new beginnings. And so you have young lovers anticipating marriage, and especially, you know, we always focus on sexual consummation, but everybody knows that first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in a carriage. And so literally the...
I'm really surprised that you know that. But sequence is important, isn't it?
It is important. That's part of the book as we try to pitch this book as part of the message. But yes, but springtime is the time of new birth, new beginnings, new life. And so a very appropriate, again, symbolic season in which to set this poem and these ideals.
So one of the things that I noticed right there at the end of 15, she says, while our vineyards are in blossom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's shared.
Right.
Something they have together.
Right.
And then the other thing that I noticed is that the foxes are threatening that.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you know, they're ruining the vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an adversary of some kind
right.
here. That's damaging.
Right. That's right. And, you know, and sexual sin, the abuse of God's gift of sexuality, is a perennial story in the Bible and human history. And so that idea of this vineyard, of their sexuality in some way being perverted, destroyed, damaged, you know, that looms here. Lots of ways to mess up sexuality before marriage, in marriage, after marriage. I mean, all of that.
Well, so that brings us to the second segment. That's a good segue, or the second question. That is, so what do we do with this? What does it mean?
Right.
Because that's what you are wondering, right? Now you talk about vineyards and blossoms and foxes. Yeah, but what does it mean? What is it trying to say? And
right.
I think you start with the vineyard being a figure for their blossoming relationship.
Right.
If Jeff and I's approach to this is correct, and this is sort of a romance being described in these poems between a man and a woman that's new and blossoming, they're falling in love with each
that's
other.
That's right. That's right.
Then it's the relationship that's figured there.
That's right. And just like any garden, any kind of, you know, intentional growing space, you know, if you ever tried to garden, you have to keep the rodents out, right? You have to keep the mice out. You have to keep the predatory animals that will come and trample the plants or eat the fruit. So too, there are foxes that threaten this garden. All gardens have to be intentionally cultivated. And so, and protected. That's why we put up walls and boundaries and gates and barbed wire and what have you, to keep these sorts of things out. And so that agricultural idea falls into this relationship as well, which is it has to be protected from external threats, predators.
So that seems to me to be her concern here.
Absolutely.
And can you understand her being concerned about that? I mean, here's this blossoming relationship. We've already seen how in love she is with him, right? Remember where the book opened? May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, verse 1.
Yeah.
She is in love with him.
Right.
And he with her back in 1:15. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. He's gone on and on about her and how in love he is with her. But now, through all this section that we've gone through where they've celebrated their blossoming love, now we have a negative, and that is a fear that she expresses here that that there may be something that ruins it.
That's right.
And I think that's common when people are falling in love, right?
Sure, absolutely. You know, there's always that risk of vulnerability that leaves us open to pain and hurt because, you know, we all know stories, even when we're younger and in our courting days, we've all known stories, everything from marriages that have failed to relationships that have been broken, to trust that's been broken and violated, to advantages that have been taken of people in emotionally vulnerable moments. And so, yeah, we've learned in this broken world, you know, Eden is under threat. You know, the protection of Eden is gone. And so Eden is at risk and the garden has to be weeded and protected.
So she's worried something's going to ruin it.
She's worried something's going to ruin
it. Something's going to mess it up.
Every good garden the human race has had has been ruined at some point. So, yeah.
So she wants him to catch the foxes, mm-hmm. to join her in protecting their vineyard. Do y'all see that? Protect this special thing that we have begun. Now, if that's correct, it does help us understand 16 better, because there is this often repeated phrase in the book, at least in some form, my beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies.
Right.
We belong together.
Commitment. Commitment. Yes. That's, I think, that's the voice or the language of commitment. That, you know, and again, you know, we see this more, I mean, it's a little bit stereotypical, but not without reason, which is that typically men tend to be more promiscuous than women. I know everyone's going to throw their counterexample, but look, we stereotype some things for a reason.
Statistically, men are.
Statistically, men are. And there's nothing new about that in our own time. That's human history. You know, it's the man who has many wives and concubines, not the woman who has many husbands, right? And so, you know, part of what, especially in the woman's voice here, you know, she's looking for commitment from a man as she gives herself to him. She, in one sense, takes on much more risk than he does. Because that's the other irony in human history, ancient and modern, is, you know, generally speaking, cultures look down upon promiscuous women more than they do on promiscuous men. It's not a level playing field. It's not fair. And so she realizes that her reputation, her name, her heart are much more at risk than his is. Because of the world being the way it is and its fallenness.
So she has this expression in 16.
That's right.
Don't let anything mess us up because
right.
we belong
right.
together.
Commitment.
And then 17.
Right.
So depending on what you do with the book, will determine how you interpret verse 17. Because verse 17 appears to be, in poetic style, an anticipation of sexual intimacy. Is
right.
that there? Do you see that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. We've already seen him compared to a gazelle elsewhere bounding around. Again, that youthful image of virility. So yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I think we are looking forward to some sort of consummation of desire. But as you and I both know, because of what we want to do with chapter 3 and then chapter 4, within the context of commitment. And so that's the crucial factor here. She wants him. She believes he wants her, but commitment, one of those, you know, especially pre-marriage, one of the foxes that could ruin a budding relationship is premarital, you know, awakening love too early, to use the parlance of the book.
Well, that's, we're going to get ahead. That's coming.
Right,
that,
right.
that warning is coming again. Right. But in this context, though, she is looking to that ultimate consummation. So you have, well, you could kind of follow it through 15, don't let anything mess us up. 16, because we belong together, and I anticipate that ultimate moment
right.
when we can be together
right.
and share sexual intimacy, because that's what the book is about.
Of course.
So what do we do with all that then?
As far
you see
as...
that? You get the picture of what's going on? The question is, how does it apply? What's the point then for me and you?
Right. Well, I think, you know, for younger people, it's a warning about sex before marriage. it's a warning about the fact that you and I both have been doing this long enough to know, and have certainly know all the studies and statistics that sit out there about this as well, which is that even among committed couples, premarital sex damages relationships. And the way that even when the sin is dealt with and repented, there's a scar there. There's a lingering darkness there. So there's that side of it. And then there's the other side, which is just within marriage, that maintaining of that fierce commitment to each other, and any fox, anything that puts at risk that commitment to each other and each other alone.
Yeah. I wonder, are you letting any foxes run around in your vineyard? I'm really impressed that even prior to marriage, she is so wanting him to be hers,
right,
for her to be him, that even before marriage, she didn't want anything to mess that up.
Right.
And yet, folks, I am astonished at the number of people who don't feel that way about their marriage. So over the years, I've had a chance to talk lots of couples who were struggling in their marriage. And it's amazing to talk to people who have let problems linger for years and years and years, unresolved and damaging the relationship. Like something comes up and we pass on and we move on, but the problem is unresolved. And it's there, and it keeps affecting the relationship. The little foxes in their vineyard, they don't seem concerned about running off.
Right.
So I wonder, do we have any foxes in our marriage? Or better, any foxes in our vineyard that, like the couple in this poem, we need to be running off. We need to be getting rid of them because they're damaging the relationship.
Right.
Something to ponder, I think, to take away from this first poem. So, after all the celebrating of this budding romance, we have a little bit of a negative tone here,
sure,
a warning, a concern.
Sure.
Something's going to come along and mess this up.
Well, you know, real relationships and real love are complicated.
Yeah, they are.
And, you know, the Hallmark Channel movies make it look like it's all onward and upward, but that's not real life.
You're baiting me to rant about Hallmark movies. I'm not going to do that. Tempting as it is.
We got time.
I'm not going there, okay? Just consider me trashing Hallmark movies and we'll move on. So the reason we were kind of glad it worked out that we didn't get the latter part of two is because this idea of being fearful and concerned about something messing it up seems to me to be continued in the next poem.
Right.
That begins in chapter 3.
Right.
And verse 1. So let's read through that together. Why don't you grab this one for us?
Okay.
And as Jeff reads, again, same question. What do you see here as you read this poem? Let's just read through it.
We're going to 5, we're going to 11.
let's go to 5.
Okay. On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The watchmen found me as they went about the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house, and into the chamber of her who conceived me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases.
So what do you see as you read that? Kind of jumps out at you. When you began, the first thing that I sort of notice is it talks about the woman in this relationship lying on her bed at night.
Correct.
And it makes Jeff and I wonder if maybe it's a dream sequence.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. I think, interestingly, both before and after what we're taking as the consummation of the marriage here in chapter 4, both before and after there, chapter 3, verse 1, and then chapter 5, verse 2, when she says, I slept, but my heart was awake. Both before and after the wedding, she's having dreams in her bed about what goes on. You ever have something that's really important to you, really on your mind, and it literally affects your sleep, what you dream, what you think about when you're asleep, half asleep? That's her. That's her. Marriage and entering into that sexual relationship is a big deal. And so it's even preoccupying her time on her in bed at night.
Except maybe isn't fair to call this a dream. Maybe it's more like a nightmare.
Well, that's right. Yeah, depending on what we want to do, that's exactly right.
Yeah, because she loses him.
That's right. It's really the fears that are keeping her up.
Yeah, she loses him. And then begins this search for him. So four times in the first two verses, I sought for him. I sought for him. I must seek him. I sought for him. So there is this redundant device. I can't find him.
Right.
And now I'm looking everywhere
right.
for him.
And going back to chapter 2, remember, commitment. She's looking for commitment. You know, he's my beloved and he's mine. And so she's looking for commitment. So this is a nightmare about he's not there. He's not there. Where is he?
Well, she solicits help.
Right.
From the guards.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, like we were talking about the other day, I mean, the short answer.
We talked a long time about the guards. Jeff thinks a lot more deeply about the guards than I did.
Well, I don't know what that says about me. and the men who sold oil to the virgins, too,
yes,
apparently.
Yeah, no. No, but let's not go there.
No.
We don't have that time.
But again, you know, parallels with chapter 5, right? If we talk about from the beginning, if chapter 4 is finally the wedding and the consummation and the wedding night, finally that moment, like we're going to get to here in a little bit tonight, hopefully. You know, the parallel here, chapter 3's nightmare, chapter 5's nightmare, watchers in both. You know, watchers are the guardians of order and security at night, right? The night watchmen, they patrol and look around. And so their job is to maintain order. Interestingly, in this one, they don't do anything. She asks them, they don't help her find him or point her in the right direction. She asks a question, and then verse 4, I've passed them. I've moved on. Chapter 5, ironically, they beat her. And we'll talk a little, or rough her up in some way. We'll talk when we get to chapter 5 about what that may be about, because that strikes us as very, very odd. But yeah, I think the watchmen, you know, ultimately, they're the protectors and guardians of right order in the night. You sleep well at night because the police are on patrol, right? And how much more in an ancient city with no street lights and absolute darkness and everything else, you counted on somebody out there to maintain law and order in the darkness. But because the way we read this story, they're not married yet, right?
Yep.
And so there's a limit to what order they can produce for her. They can't tell her where he is because that's really not purely her business yet at night. They're not married yet.
Well, and so she finds him.
She does find him.
And then this is where it gets weird.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Did y'all think verse 4 was weird too?
Yeah.
She brings him to her mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me.
Right.
Which is strange.
Right. Right.
And then 5 is the repeated warning,
right,
not to awaken love until she pleases.
Sure.
So, what do we do with all of that?
Okay.
What does all that mean?
All right. So again, you know, going back to she's wanting commitment, that maybe his lack of a commitment. She's worried about losing him. What happens if he doesn't stay faithful, whatever.
So pause for a second.
Yeah.
That's the same thing we were seeing at the end of 2.
Correct. That's
so
the point.
The same kind of issues
point.
Are surfacing.
That's right.
It's
only now it's keeping her up at night.
But isn't that true as a relationship grows more dear and precious? She's not having nightmares about a guy she went out with once.
Right.
She's having nightmares about a guy that she's fallen for.
Right.
Head over heels. And she thinks he's the one.
Right.
But now something may happen to them.
That's right. That's right. And the other thing that's important to remember, because I take the taking him to her mother's house, to the chamber of her conceiving, is the desire for sexual union with him. This is a dream, though. This is her dreaming of how she wants the commitment of a family's blessing. You know, the golden mother's house is parental blessing. It's marriage proper. She wants to be married properly and enter into the circle of life again. We focus on sexuality mostly for pleasure. It's there. In the ancient world, they never separated the pleasure from the babies that come with it, though. And so to go to her mother's chamber where she was conceived was to enter into a proper sexual union, context of marriage, family's blessing. And now she becomes the next mother in the cycle. So she's taking her mother's place, going to the place that she herself came from, which is, you know, marital sexual union and the children that come from that. But again, she's dreaming. She's not there yet. That's what she wants, though. To find him is to find him in a commitment. And that's the context in which she finds him. She finds him and marries him, so to speak.
So it occurred to me that the poem at the end of 2 really is structured just like the poem at the beginning of 3.
Okay.
Where you had this fear in the end of 2, the foxes
right.
upsetting the vineyard.
Right.
And then this statement, we belong together.
Right.
And then the closing picture of sexual intimacy, the ultimate culmination of
right.
this relationship. Right?
Right.
And so then we get to 3, another fear. She loses him.
Right.
Can't find him. And then she does. In fact, it talks about when I found him, I wouldn't let go of him. We belong
right.
together, right?
Right.
And then closes with a picture of sexual intimacy.
Right.
So it's kind of structured the same way each of these
yeah.
each of these poems expressing her fears. Except here, we close with verse 5.
Right.
Which is that warning about sexual purity.
That's right. That's right. You know, again, you know, this is her desiring for marital consummation, not promiscuous consummation of this desire. She wants committed love. And so don't to any young girls having similar dreams, don't go looking for this the wrong time, the wrong way, the wrong place.
So that statement in 5, this is the second time
right.
we've essentially seen the same thing.
Right.
And it's going to appear again
mm-hmm.
before we get done, just in these 8 short chapters.
Right.
We have that repeated idea over and over again. Do not awaken love until it pleases, implying, and I think properly in the context of these 2 poems we've seen, that there is a right time for
right.
this.
Absolutely.
So when we think about the 3rd question, does this have any application? Do you see it? How about an application for our young people? How about teaching them this idea of there being a right time for love to be awakened and for sexual intimacy to be explored?
Right. Rather than demonizing the desire itself, which is too often, I think, you know, the implicit message we give to young people who are, you know, feeling those awakenings of passion and desire. The desire is not wrong or immoral or dirty in and of itself. The goal is to understand it's about the right time, the right place, the right way.
And I think that's really important, an important conversation for parents to have with their kids
right.
about these feelings they're having for these people they're dating or maybe someone they're falling in love with, that the desire we feel from each other is a God-given
right.
part of who we are.
Right.
When a young man looks at a young woman and is physically attracted to her, God made him to be attracted to her
right.
and vice versa.
Right.
And so I think it's good to be honest with kids about that. This is where that's coming from.
Right.
But in the context of, and this is what that's for. Y'all see that? There's a time for this. God's
right.
God's created the place for this.
Right.
And so you need to wait until that time.
Right. And sometimes we so emphasize the wrong time and place to our young people that we almost leave them with feelings of guilt in the right time and the right place more than we realize sometimes, perhaps. And so sometimes young people struggle, ironically, when they finally enter into the vineyards the right way, because we've so guilted them about the nature of these feelings. And so it really is a fine line to walk, admittedly, but we need both sides of that message.
I wonder if you surveyed Christians and asked them how many people on your honeymoon felt like you were doing something
Absolutely.
Wrong. I wonder how many Christians, if they could just be honest, would say, Yeah,
that's right.
It felt wrong. And I got to tell you, folks, that is a sign.
Correct.
That our message has been inadequate.
Right.
Because what we should have been saying is, at this time,
right.
it's as God intended and it's beautiful and it's perfect.
Right. And the irony is that becomes a fox itself that threatens the vineyard.
Ah, yes. Back to the foxes. You ready to press on?
Yes, probably should.
You think so? Oh, man, we're doing great on time tonight. Famous last words. So the rest of 6, Jeff and I had to wrestle with whether or not all of chapter 3 goes together or there's a division at 6. I guess you agreed with me since we're breaking it here, huh?
Well, I think it's a different section. I think it's still part of the same thing.
By the way, who do you think is speaking in 6 through 11? That's our next segment,
yeah,
6 through 11.
Yeah, I take it as her continuing with her dream sequence. She's kind of having visions in the night, so to speak. I see a number of connections between the 2 sections. You know, it's got her mother in verse 4, Solomon's mother in verse 11, the daughters of Jerusalem in verse 5, and daughters of Zion in verse 11, or vice versa, I forget. Verse 5, the daughters are told to wait for a wedding. Verse 11, Solomon has a wedding. So there's a lot of connections between them. I think the way I read it, there's a continuation of her dream sequence. But another way of dealing with what's at issue there, which is her fear of lack of commitment from him.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity to illustrate the sometimes varied interpretation.
Correct. That's exactly right. Because this is one of the harder things in the book. What do you do with these verses? That's absolutely
right.
And
see, I really see these tied to 4. I think they are the preamble to what's coming in chapter 4.
Sure.
So now that you've heard Jeff and I fight about it, you guys can listen to this and make some judgments of your own.
Right.
Let's pick up at 6. Read from 6 to 11. What is this coming up from the wilderness? Like columns of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant. Behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon. 60 mighty men around it, of all the mighty men of Israel. All of them are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. He made its post of silver, its back of gold, and its seat of purple fabric, with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze at King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. So, what do you see? We should probably talk about what a sedan chair is.
Yeah.
Yeah, were you reading that thinking, what the? They go out to look at this thing, I don't even know what it is.
It's Tesla makes it now. No, that's...
Wow.
No, I'm not
touching that.
No, it was basically, you know, think of like a palanquin or just something where, you know, you typically see in your
palanquin
old...
Palanquin doesn't help, buddy.
I know. It's getting worse, actually. Yeah. No, you know, it's like a chair or a couch that's carried by 4 men. I mean, you know, it's, you know, for
so
the...
think Ark of the Covenant, poles on each side, and the chest in the middle. Pull out the chest, stick a chair in there with a guy sitting in it. That's
ancient version of a stretch limo. Because it's interesting you say that.
That's exactly what this is.
Yeah, no, I know. I did that on purpose. But to your point, a lot of these materials, there is some Ark of the Covenant. You know, there's obviously royal imagery in that. But some Ark, I mean, these are materials that are similar to the Ark. You're right. Only the problem is, you know, rather than it being God in the middle of it, it's a king. And depending on what you do with Solomon, you know, either it's a good image or it's an image of his libido. But anyways,
we'll talk about that. So notice, go back to the beginning at 6. There's this dust cloud. There's an entourage coming, and in the middle of it is this sedan chair with Solomon riding on it, and a contingent of soldiers all around. And the interesting thing here is all of this detail about how fancy this thing is, fitting for a king, right?
Well, that's certainly the point.
And for the occasion. Which is?
Well, yeah, there's some sort of wedding. I mean, obviously the crown is mentioned, the mother crowns him on his wedding day. And so, again, you know, you have the woman who's looking for some sort of commitment. And commitment makes you think of weddings.
Yeah. So remember that when we started all of this, Jeff, one of the things we agree on about the song is that there is a wedding right in the middle of the book, right? That's not exactly right. There's a honeymoon right in the middle of the book, which is really the focus.
Yeah.
And Jeff and I believe the poems that go before that reflect the blossoming romance. And the poems that follow are about romance after the wedding, more romance and marriage.
Right.
And so this is kind of the halfway point for us. And 6 sort of builds us up into that.
Right.
By announcing the wedding. The interesting thing here is, how much are you told about the wedding other than Solomon's arrival? Yeah, Zippo. We don't know what she wore. We don't know what they served. We don't know how long the party went on. Nothing. It's because the book isn't about weddings. The book is about sex. And so the groom arrives and we go straight to the honeymoon, because that's what the book is about.
Right.
So we need to talk about what all this preamble in 6 through 11, what this is all about. about. And I guess we might as well deal with the Solomon question at this point. It's as good a time as any. It's one of the great struggles that interpreters have with the Song of Solomon, and that is deciding about Solomon, because he's in the book.
He's in the book.
He's
not as much as you'd think.
He's here.
Yep. Chapter 3 and chapter 8 are where he's name checked.
Yeah. So there is one school of thought that believes Solomon is the other half of this relationship. He is the groom. He is the one with whom the woman is in love, which strikes some people as odd in a book that's supposed to be about God's view of the sexual relationship. We have a main figure in that being this polygamous king.
Right.
Hardly seems fitting, right?
Right.
Unless Song of Solomon is designed to be sort of the rebuttal to polygamy. Some of us think that.
Right.
That this is against that background. This is presenting what God's plan is supposed to be.
Right.
But not everybody sees Solomon as a player in the book.
No, that's right. No, that's right. And I'd put myself in that camp. I like I mentioned a second ago, I think this is a continuation of her dream. And he's a foil. He's a foil. To your point, you know, people do see it's ironic, you know, Solomon, who knows nothing about monogamous committed love, would be the hero of a wedding song. And so, yeah, I see him as a foil here. You know, he's either the guy himself finally named, or he's a foil. It has to be one or the other. And I think when you look at some things specifically here, as well as the book as a whole, I think he serves as a foil. I already mentioned some of the links between verses 1 through 5 and 6 through 11. But here's what you come down to as well, is if she's afraid of the man not being exclusive to her, going back to 2, 5, 15 through 17, she's worried about my beloved is mine and I am his. She's worried about mutuality and exclusivity. What better foil could there be to somebody, even in marriage, who's not exclusive, but Solomon? And so again, even playing off of 1 through 5 and 6 through 11, you have some interesting comparisons and contrasts. You have the unprotected woman at night in the city versus the extremely protected king in broad daylight. He was protected by more men than David. And so in one sense, what you have here is almost a contrast of this, you know, almost, you could say almost crass, overdone opulence of Solomon and his materialism and his hedonistic lifestyle, who ironically doesn't know anything of true love. Maybe that's part of the point. Because, you know, there's almost a point of almost a laugh line to my reading here in verse 11. You know, and you know, Solomon's mother crowns him with the crown on the day of his wedding. But you stop and you say, well, which wedding? I mean, that's part of the problem for Solomon, right? Which wedding? He's not the hero of monogamous committed love, if what we're saying about 15 through 17 is right, her fears. He's the opposite. And so part of her ongoing nightmare, she found her man. She in her dream, gets him back to her mother's chamber. They continue the circle of life together as husband and wife, having their own children. You know, what's that lingering fear, that or the great illustration of her lingering fear is a promiscuous man like Solomon, who even in marriage doesn't maintain it. The open and obvious, you know, flamboyance of Solomon's hedonistic sexuality. And I think that part of what helps bear that out is, and we haven't gotten there yet, but chapter 8, verses 11 through 14, the woman speaks, Solomon is named again, but she zings him for all his vineyards, but my own I have not let go. You know, he has too many vineyards. He has too many women in his life. I'm not that kind of girl. And so I take him more as a foil in the book, and this is part of her dream, her nightmare.
So you'll have to figure out what to do with Solomon.
Because poetry is poetry.
Poetry is poetry. Yeah. But you know, whichever way you go with that, you end up at the same place.
Correct. And that's the big picture point.
We're seeing this as God designed it to be.
That's right.
So talk a little bit about what we do with this segment. One of the things I do like about this section is the way the wedding is a big deal.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me in our culture, I don't want to say weddings aren't big deals, but they're big deal for all the wrong reasons.
Well, that's the key. Is that ironically, the wedding's a big deal, but it's the say yes to the dress mentality where, you know.
I'm surprised you know that too.
I got three daughters.
That is true. true.
But more to the point, you know, I mean, you know, we've all seen, you know, you're standing in the grocery checkout line. You're trying not to look at the magazines because they're just ugly and worldly and depressing. But there's always some People magazine cover about, you know, some celebrity's $70,000 wedding, you know, over the weekend. Except it's ironically, it's like Solomon, which wedding, you know, for these celebrities, where the thing itself and the opulence and the extravagance is the point. The wedding is the point, not the marriage.
And so many weddings that just seems to me are pointless parties.
That's right.
You know, the vast majority of couples have already shared what is celebrated in chapter 4.
That's right.
That sexual intimacy.
That's right.
But it really goes so much further than that. There are growing numbers of couples who have already moved in together, bought a house together.
Right.
And in a growing number of cases have already had children.
I was about to say already have kids.
Yeah,
that's right.
They've already started the family, and what should have been at the beginning of this, as right. It is in this book, actually comes at the end. It's a pointless party. Heidi and I were sailing a few years ago. In fact, do y'all remember when you were doing Harvey? We were on a sailboat in Maine when all that was going on. So y'all can be bitter with us about
unnecessary.
That. Yes. But,
unnecessary.
But a couple actually, there are about 20 of us on the boat, a couple actually got married on the boat. Captain performed the wedding ceremony the last night we were on the boat. Here's a weird thing. They were already a couple on the boat. Have I said enough about that? Do you understand what I mean?
They had one cabin.
One cabin.
Yeah. Now,
that's the delicate way to say that. In fact, oddly enough, as the captain's doing the ceremony, he says, how long y'all been together? And they say 10 years. And he said, well, it's a good thing since y'all been living in sin all this time. We're going to make this right. I wanted to amen at that point. I just didn't think it would be appropriate.
I don't think that was his point.
But, well, it wasn't really a sermon.
Yeah.
But the point was, what are we doing?
Right. Right.
It's a pointless party.
That's right. It's literally make people feel good about themselves rather than to do right before God and man.
And so weddings need to be a big deal, but they need to be a big deal for the right reason.
Right.
That this is covenant making.
And we're truly properly going to the mother's chamber for the right, you know, and that's the whole point.
Well, and so there is that piece of it, the sexual intimacy that was preserved and saved for this occasion as God intended that it should be, which attaches, again, another dimension of specialness to the occasion.
Right.
When I talk to young people about this, one of the things I will ask them is, have you ever opened your gifts before Christmas? Y'all ever do that? Do you ever peek? I have been guilty of that, but I want to say it was my older sister's fault. They corrupted me and led me astray. But it ruins it, doesn't it? And I think that's the message about not waiting for sexual intimacy. It ruins what is meant to be a special shared moment.
Yeah.
Between a husband and wife.
And along that line, David, you know, a lot of times in our culture, and you see something really radically out of balance, it's because it's compensating for something else that's missing or been sublimated. And I think that part of the reason weddings have become a multi-billion-dollar industry is because people are compensating, trying to make it something special, because what generally should make a wedding special has already been spent, has already been lost. And so we're compensating. Now, I think about, you know, we've been binge watching Andy Griffith in our house with the kids off and on in recent weeks, and there was an episode here that we watched. I know we're way behind. We're just finally getting to Andy Griffith, but it's really fun with our kids to just go literally, you know, a world they've never known. I mean, Mayberry, man,
black and white TV.
Yeah, it's been fun with the kids to do all things, you know, 4:3 ratio. Now, anyways, you know, young couple, you know, going to elope to the justice, you know, Andy Griffith's also justice of the peace in Mayberry there. And just, you know, the simplicity of their ambition, just wanting to get married so they can just start living as husband and wife. No fanciness, no frills. We used to understand that, you know, that the wedding, the opulence of the wedding was not the point. But we're compensating in our culture. And I think maybe we need to think about that more.
So we've got about 10 minutes to touch on 4.
Oh, look, we are in a rush.
Huh?
We are in a rush.
Well, we've talked about 4 before. Do y'all remember
That's
this?
Right.
When we did great chapters
That's
of
fair.
The Bible, we talked about chapter
yeah.
4. And so we didn't really plan to spend a lot of time here and give us more time to work through the rest of the book. But without reading all of this again, Just to give a quick summary of the chapter, basically, chapter 4 is the wedding night, delicately treated in poetic form.
Something almost unrecognizable in our pornographic culture, yeah. where we would, you know, somebody would do this in a completely different fashion today.
Yeah, so the bulk of the chapter, actually verses 1 through 11, you can kind of tweak how you see the list here, but the bulk of the chapter is as a list.
Right.
Where on their wedding night, the groom, whoever that might be, Solomon or otherwise,
yeah.
is telling his bride how beautiful she is.
And I think that's important. You know, as much as we, you know, I don't know if we really focus on this or not, you know, the woman's voice is the dominant voice in the book as a whole. It's she does most of the talking. Not going to make any jokes about that. But
wow, you didn't need to add that.
Harvey, buddy, you were sailing in Harvey.
Man, you're...
Okay. So anyways, it's important. You know, again, if what we've been doing in chapter 2 and the chapter 3, don't look at me that way. Chapter 2, chapter 3, where again, maybe her fears for the relationship, you know, the foxes that can destroy the vineyard, her desire for security and intimacy. It's so important. It's his voice that's speaking here. And this literally head-to-toe verbal undressing hover, as it were. But the point is, he's reassuring her of his love, his interest, his commitment, his satisfaction in her and with her. You know, that's very important that now he is speaking to these insecurities that have been lingering and even given her nightmares preceding the wedding. And again, I think there's a lesson there. You and I both have talked about when our premarital counseling we do with young couples, the importance of talking to especially husbands-to-be about the importance of how you treat your wife in those vulnerable moments.
Yeah, because people who have preserved their purity.
This is a big deal.
Have not been together.
This is a big deal.
An awkward, uncomfortable moment.
Right.
And a lot of uncertainty and insecurity. We've encountered her insecurity before back
right.
in chapter 1.
Right.
Where she is among the kept women, and yet her skin is dark because
right.
she's been out in the sun.
Right.
And so...
Right.
And so those insecurities were present. And in chapter 1, he really speaks to that. He addresses
right.
that with her. And I think we see the same thing going on here. And one of the things I think is really important about that as we jump around with applications in this chapter, notice, guys, that the male role in this story recognizes and is sensitive to how his new wife is going to feel on this occasion.
Correct.
He is aware of what it would be like for her to be undressed in front of him for the first time. And he takes steps to put her at ease. And if you read down through this section, what he basically just does is he goes from head to toe and says, here's how beautiful you are to me. Here's what I
right.
think of you. I think reassuring her and comforting her. And that's those first 11 verses are really working his list.
Right. And so for you know a woman, a wife-to-be or a new wife, or even a long-term wife for that matter, you know, when the issue is I'm worried, you know, men tend to be more promiscuous than women stereotypically. We're working at the 30,000 foot level here. You know, it is so important for the woman to know that the man is satisfied with her. I mean, why, you know, she needs to know that he's not looking anywhere else. She needs to know that, you know, unlike, again, if you like me, take Solomon as the foil, who, yeah, it's a wedding today, but there's going to be, you know, 299 others, not to mention the concubines along the way. I am deeply and completely and fully satisfied with you, my love.
And since you always get ahead.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
After they've been married a while, he's going to say that too.
Well, that's right. There's still chapter 7.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And
there never comes a time where a wife doesn't need to be reassured about that.
That's exactly right. And ironically, you know, chapter 7 may be even more racier than the wedding night. I mean, that's the irony is, if anything, it's
that was a plug to get you to come back. So,
yeah.
So the description in verses 1 through 11, that's his list on their wedding night,
yeah.
how beautiful she is to him.
Right.
And then in 12 through 16 is what we would have to describe as the lovemaking scene, though again couched in delicate poetry so as not to make it pornographic. I think the main figure there is the woman as a garden.
Right.
And
we've been dealing with this vineyard and garden imagery all the way through.
Right. And so 12, she's locked.
Right. She has protected her virginity to this point.
And I think that's the point. Up to this point,
right.
Her virginity has been protected. But all these wonderful things are inside this garden.
Right.
And unexperienced up to this point.
Well, and again, look at the imagery. You know, we're rushing through because we got sex on the brain here. Verses 13 and 14. You know, these are common people. She's a simple girl who's been doing manual labor, chapter 1. And yet these things, we just take it for granted because you can go to Kroger tonight and buy cinnamon. I mean, this is stuff that only kings got. This is the best stuff that only the elite and the richest, the most powerful in the world got back in those days. And yet, the fact of the matter is, again, my reading, contrary to Solomon's opulence, the king's ransom is available for any man who will be faithful to a good woman. And that's the beauty of it here is you know, that which cannot be bought. Again, chapter 8, her zinging Solomon. That which cannot be bought is available for the right man who will make the commitment to her to be hers and hers alone.
Celebrating the beauty and the pleasure of sexual love then, using
monogamous, committed sexual love, absolutely.
And so he goes into detail describing the garden.
Right.
But then 16,
yeah,
the very end of the verse there, may my beloved come into his garden and eat its choice fruits. That's the invitation to come.
Consummation.
To experience.
That's
that
right.
Now.
That's right. And then the thing that I love is, so you have her invitation, and then chapter 5, verse 1, again, chapter break in the wrong place.
I know, and I have to agree with you about that.
As much as it bugs you.
Yes, it does, but 5:1 clearly belongs.
Oh, absolutely.
At the end of chapter 4.
But what catches my eye is, from her invitation, you know, kind of future tense, come in, chapter 5, verse 1, I came. And so now it's you know, him saying afterwards, it's like a done deal. And so the actual moment of consummation, what happens? What was it like? What did he say and she say and he think and she think and experience? None of your stinking business is what the Bible's saying. In a world that thrives upon voyeurism, you know, selfies of vacation and last night's dinner and everything else, we live in a TMI culture. And the point of the matter is, too, and I think this is why the book is poetry, every couple's experience is unique and their own. It's not an arms race. It's not, you know, in the pornographic culture, we compare experiences and see who had better. There's no such thing as better. There's only yours and ours. And that's the Bible's view. What actually happened on the wedding night? None of your stinking business is what the Bible's saying. But it was great.
But then, at the very end of that verse, you have this blessing
on
what they've done.
That's
Look
right.
at the very end of chapter 5, verse 1. Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers. And so they preserve their purity. Now they've welcomed each other into that realm
right.
on their wedding night.
Right.
And then at the end, there's a blessing pronounced on it. Yes, sure. This is good, and enjoy it again and again.
Right.
So who's the speaker there at the end?
Well, you know, some would say it's the daughters of Jerusalem. I mean, that's, you know, the only other voice we've got there. It could be God's voice.
Yeah, boy, I'm so tempted to say that's God weighing in there and giving his blessing. And so just before we run out of time, I want you to think about your kids again and the value of sharing with them a message like this. I think Jeff and I both, in our private work with couples before marriage, I know that I will do a thing with guys called the groom talk where I walk through this with him. But the truth is, most of the time I have to do that because mom and dad have never done
right.
it.
Right.
What an important role for mom and dad to sit down and talk about this chapter, mom coming from a woman's perspective, dad coming from a man perspective, and help them see the beautiful picture of sex when it's saved for the right time and in the right relationship, as God intended that would be. Folks, our kids need that message. We need to commend this to them as what God intended, rather than just fill them up with warnings, don't have sex before you get married.
That's right. That's right. You have the Garden of Eden, and then where this all started, and now you have the Garden and the Song of Songs, where we still get back to Eden in its own small way.
So when we pick this back up, can I just point out to you that the book doesn't end at the end of chapter 4?
Which is where the Disney movie always ends. Yeah.
And by the way, neither does romantic love And so we need to press on through the second half of the book that's going to talk about that. We're out of time for that tonight. Let's pray together. Thank you, God, for the privilege of gathering with your people and in your presence to think about your plan for the sexual relationship. And we pray that you would give us wisdom to honor you in that part of our married life, but also to share that message with our children to give them their view, your view of this important subject. In Jesus' name, amen.